So I want you to picture a seven-story building, but you know, it's not some sleek glass high-rise.
Right, definitely not glass.
And it isn't a brutalist concrete block either. It is a literal, gigantic, woven picnic basket, complete with these two massive handles curving right up into the sky.
It's such a wild image, honestly.
It really is. Now picture that same giant basket, completely empty, just quietly sitting in the middle of a desolate Ohio cornfield. Because today, for this deep dive, you asked us to look at that exact surreal building alongside a stack of sources that honestly seem entirely disconnected at first glance.
Yeah, they really do seem all over the map.
Right. I mean, we are looking at the political fragmentation of Europe, an economic debate over Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's definition of a billionaire, an essay on why artificial intelligence cannot write great poetry, and of all things, the try-hard aesthetic of the Met Gala,
It's a very eclectic
to
mix.
say the least. So our mission today is to figure out the hidden thread tying these seemingly unrelated pieces of the modern world together.
And, opening the show with the most important insights always helps us anchor the conversation. So before we get into the weeds, I want to give you the signal cutting through the noise. Across all these articles and essays, there are basically four key takeaways.
Okay, lay 'em on me. What's the first one?
First, we are looking at political paralysis. So across Europe, the center-right is collapsing, much like social democrats did a decade ago, and it's leaving this fragmented landscape that is entirely paralyzed by the protection of vested interests.
Got it. And the second.
Second is an authenticity crisis. From the sudden decline in young Westerners wanting to travel abroad to the cringe era of the Met Gala, we are basically losing our fundamental belief in transformative, genuine experiences.
That's depressing, but okay. Number three.
Third is the emptiness of the expected. We'll explore why AI cannot write great poetry because it is mathematically optimized for the expected, whereas true human art actually requires the shock of surprise.
Makes sense. And the last one.
Fourth is the subjectivity of wealth. The fierce debate over whether billionaires, earn their money is ultimately a clash of moral definitions, not economics. And it's masking much deeper anxieties about how society actually rewards value.
Wow. Okay. So we are really dealing with systems, whether they're political, economic, or cultural, that are just fracturing under the weight of their own past successes. Let's start with the physical and political breakdown of the old world order, because the transcript you provided featuring historian Timothy Garton-Ash, well, it paints a pretty stark picture of Europe right now.
It really does. Garton-Ash basically breaks down a total fragmentation of the political landscape that, we've taken for granted for decades. Britain's a prime example of
Because they've
this.
always had that neat two-party system, right?
Exactly. For a long time, the UK operated on a fairly stable two-party model. But Garton-Ash notes that British politics have now become very European. The electorate is fracturing into five distinct parties, or even seven if you factor in the Scottish and Welsh nationalists.
Wait, seven parties? That is a massive shift. So the established institutions are just floundering trying to adapt to that new math.
Oh, absolutely. The conservatives are dealing with the fallout of 14 years of what Garton-Ash characterizes as severe misrule. And meanwhile, Labour's Keir Starmer is being viewed by a lot of voters as a chameleon.
Right, like someone who shifts colors to survive but lacks a positive defining program of his own.
Precisely. And into that specific void steps, Reform UK. Now, Garton-Ash makes a really crucial distinction here that we should point out. Reform UK is less like Viktor Orban's party in Hungary.
Which has systematically dismantled democratic checks, right?
Right, exactly. Instead, Reform UK is more akin to Giorgia Meloni's hard-right populist party in Italy, meaning they operate within the democratic structure but pull the entire conversation sharply to the right.
Which is fascinating. And Garton-Ash argues this isn't just an isolated British phenomenon, is it?
No. Not at all. He says the center-right is collapsing across Europe, which actually mirrors the collapse of the Social Democrats in the 2000s and 2010s. The political center of gravity has, well, it's just evaporated.
But then he looks at Germany, and they're suffering from a totally different, almost bureaucratic flavor of paralysis. I mean, Germany is staring down a triple threat. They've lost their supply of cheap Russian energy, the longstanding U.S. security guarantee is suddenly being questioned, and their massive Chinese export market has transformed into a direct competitor.
It's a perfect storm.
But the wild part is, Germany actually has the capital to address this. They have roughly €1 trillion to spend.
They do, yeah. But they are trapped by a concept Garton-Ash calls impossibilism.
impossibilism.
Yeah, it basically means there are so many checks, balances, and veto points built into the German system that taking any decisive action becomes impossible. He highlights this specific German term, Besitzstandsverwahrung.
I am definitely not going to try to pronounce that. What does it mean?
It essentially translates to the protection of vested interests. It describes a society that has grown incredibly comfortable and is now paralyzed by a desperate need to protect the status quo, even as a literal war rages right next door in Ukraine.
Okay, let's unpack this, because Germany's Besitzstandsverwahrung sounds exactly like a neighborhood homeowners association.
Oh, that's a good comparison. How so?
Well, imagine you have a massive leak in the roof, you have the money in the bank to fix it, but the HOA refuses to let you hire a contractor because you haven't filled out the right heritage preservation paperwork in triplicate.
Right, the bureaucracy gets in the way.
Exactly. The rules designed to protect the house end up guaranteeing that the roof caves in.
That's it, exactly. The structure is prioritized over the function it was supposed to serve. And we see this exact same dynamic when an entity believes its past success guarantees its future survival.
Which brings us perfectly to the most vivid artifact in your reading list. Because this idea that past success breeds a paralyzing overconfidence, it isn't just a European political problem, it is an economic one. Let's look at the Longaberger Basket Company, which was detailed in that piece from Dispatch Culture by Johnny Gartner.
Oh, the Longaberger story. It is a fascinating case study in scaling a very specific kind of economic engine.
It really is.
So founded in 1972 in Dresden, Ohio, the company hit over $1 billion in annual sales by the year 2000. I mean, they employed 8,000 people and had a staggering 70,000 sales associates. They were absolute titans of the multi-level marketing era.
And they were selling a highly curated, nostalgic slice of Americana. Like, thousands of associates were essentially hosting Tupperware-style parties, but for woven maplewood baskets.
Yeah, exactly.
And the company was so incredibly flush with cash and so confident in that specific business model that they built that 7-story basket headquarters we talked about. They even installed heated handles so ice wouldn't form on the building in the Ohio winters.
Which is just, I mean, committing to a novelty corporate fortress on that scale requires a profound, almost hubristic belief that your specific economic engine will run forever.
But the era shifted.
It did. The multi-level marketing model reached saturation. Consumer tastes moved away from rustic Americana toward cheaper mass-produced home goods, and the entire socioeconomic model just evaporated. The company closed its doors in 2016 and filed for bankruptcy in 2018.
And today, that massive basket sits entirely vacant. It is a surreal monument to deindustrialization. Gartner brings a deeply personal lens to this in his essay, too.
He does, yeah.
He mentions having his grandmother's Longaberger mail basket sitting right on his desk. It's this intimate, everyday object that serves as a reminder of a massive systemic collapse.
Right. And if the old engines of value, like massive Midwest manufacturing and multi-level marketing empires, are dead, and if the old political systems in Europe are paralyzed by their own bureaucracy, it forces us to ask how we evaluate the new engines of value.
Like, how do we measure the hyper-successful people who are actually thriving in today's fractured economy?
Exactly. And that is the perfect bridge to Noah Smith's newsletter. Because he strips away the partisan rhetoric to look purely at the economic mechanism behind Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's famous claim.
The quote where she says, "You can't earn $1 billion." Just to be clear for you listening, we are not taking political sides here. We're just exploring the mechanics of the argument.
Right, absolutely. Smith uses this quote to explore a deep underlying tension about how we define the word earned, because the word earned functions completely differently depending on your foundational worldview.
How so?
Well, Smith outlines the two primary definitions. First is the socialist definition, which argues that only labor income truly counts. Any income derived from capital, investments, or owning the means of production is inherently unearned.
Right. But the problem with applying that broadly is that it leads to an endless, unresolvable moral debate about the exact ratio of labor to capital in any given fortune, because it's completely subjective.
Exactly. Then you have the flip side, which is the strict free market definition. Economists refer to that as marginal product.
Marginal product, meaning like,
right,
what exactly?
It asks a brutal but objective question. How much poorer would society be if you had never existed? If you created a completely new industry, your marginal product is massive.
Okay, I see.
The issue here is that while it is an objective concept in theory, it is completely unknowable in practice. We cannot run a parallel universe simulation to calculate the exact dollar value a single founder added to the global economy.
Yeah, most people intuitively reject both of those academic extremes. So what is the actual mechanism behind AOC's statement then?
Well, Smith interprets her stance as suggesting that accumulating $1 billion requires a fundamental level of badness. It's the idea that nobody gets to a billion purely through luck or hard work. Getting there requires exploitation of labor or a ruthless breaking of the rules.
But to test the mechanics of that theory, Smith brings up an incredibly illustrative counterexample, Taylor Swift.
Yes. She has built a fortune estimated at roughly $2 billion. How did she do it? Primarily through the music catalog she wrote and owns. Technically speaking, she utilizes government-granted intellectual property monopolies.
Meaning copyright law.
Exactly. A copyright is entirely a creation of the state. It grants the creator exclusive market power over an idea or a piece of art.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Taylor Swift didn't ruthlessly exploit factory workers, and she didn't violate antitrust laws to crush competitors in a predatory way. She wrote hit songs, and she played entirely within the bounds of copyright law. But she still amassed a fortune that triggers that billionaire critique.
And Smith's broader point is that if you apply the standard that billion-dollar fortunes are inherently unearned or immoral, you end up implicating virtually all of modern American capitalism.
Right.
Almost every major company driving the U.S. economy, employing millions of people, was founded by someone who became a billionaire. Their immense personal wealth and the broad economic value they generated are deeply, inextricably intertwined.
Okay, but I want to push back on the core premise of the Taylor Swift example just a bit to encourage some critical thinking here. If we accept that she earned her billions through IP rules, which, as you said, are copyright laws created and enforced by the government, aren't all billionaires just playing the game by the government's rule book?
That's a fair question.
So what does this all mean for you as the listener? Is society's actual anger directed at the amount of wealth or the method of how it's acquired? Whether a billionaire uses the tax code to offset real estate losses or patent a law to protect a pharmaceutical drug, they are operating within the system the state designed.
And that is a crucial distinction. Are people angry at the players or are they angry at the game? This brings up the concept of rent-seeking.
Wait, rent-seeking? Just to make sure we are clear on the mechanism here, you mean using your wealth or influence to rewrite the rules in your favor, right? Getting a larger slice of the economic pie for yourself without actually making the overall pie any bigger.
Precisely. Rent-seeking is lobbying for a loophole that only benefits your corporation, rather than innovating a better product. Smith suggests that instead of starting from the assumption that all massive fortunes are inherently ill-gotten, we need to accept that great wealth is built on a very messy combination.
A combination of what?
Of sheer luck, extreme talent, following the rules of the game, and yes, occasional rent-seeking behavior. He argues that we should accept that complex reality and calibrate our taxation systems accordingly, rather than relying on moral absolutes.
And there's a political risk if we don't, right?
Yeah. He points out that Democrats are increasingly becoming the party of millionaires against billionaires, which creates a fractured coalition that complicates their ability to build a broad functional welfare state.
Interesting. So we have looked at political structures paralyzed by their own rules and economic definitions of value that completely fracture depending on your worldview. Let's pivot to culture. Because if our political and economic systems are optimizing for scale and efficiency, what happens to genuine human surprise? What happens to authenticity?
The three essays in the Weekender newsletter tackle this cultural crisis brilliantly. Let's start with Nabil S. Qureshi's piece on why AI cannot write great poetry.
Oh, I loved this one. We've all seen ChatGPT generate a poem. It rhymes perfectly, the meter is correct, but it always feels hollow.
Yeah, it does. And Qureshi explains this by looking at how the human brain processes reality versus how an algorithm constructs a sentence.
He talks about the predictive processing model of the brain, right?
Exactly. The brain is essentially an inference machine. We are constantly subconsciously predicting what is going to happen next based on our past experiences. Large language models, or LLMs, are built on a similar but much more rigid mathematical concept.
Right, because they are optimized to predict the next most likely token or word in a sequence. They were literally engineered to give you the most statistically expected outcome.
Which means they are structurally punished for taking a risk.
Yeah. But great human art relies on the exact opposite mechanism. It relies on the deliberate violation of expectation.
Yes. Qureshi cites Shakespeare's Macbeth, the multitudinous season Carnadine, or the poet Philip Larkin describing how a hothouse flashed uniquely. He even brings up visual art.
Oh, the Fra Angelico piece.
Right, the Renaissance painter Fra Angelico painting a stark, inexplicable black stripe in the middle of a fresco. Great art works by systematically introducing surprise. Tolstoy called it defamiliarization, making the familiar seem strange so we can truly see it again.
But AI systematically underweights the surprising word because the algorithm views unpredictability as an error.
Exactly. It irons out the surprise.
Wait, if an AI is punished for picking a surprising word, then a modern fashion influencer is essentially operating as an AI.
Wait, walk me through that connection.
Think about the essay by Anastasia Vartanian on the Met Gala's descent into absolute cringe. AI writing poetry is exactly like the Met Gala right now.
Oh, I see where you're going.
She traces the golden era of the Met Gala back to 2015 when Rihanna wore that massive yellow Guopay cape. It was a genuine surprise. It violated our expectations of what a red carpet looked like. But today, the online fashion world is suffering from what Vartanian calls brain rot.
Right. Influencers and designers are just trying to reverse engineer a viral moment.
Exactly. They are punished by the social media algorithm if they wear something that doesn't fit the expected dimensions of a viral meme. They are both perfectly optimized to generate the most mathematically expected version of a viral moment, which ironically makes them completely unsurprising and, well, cringe.
They're just predicting the next token to maximize engagement.
Yes. It's all feed performance. Vartanian points out that actual tactile quality, the weight of the fabric, the physical craftsmanship is lost entirely because the digital screen flattens everything. The Met Gala is functioning exactly like an LLM.
Wow. When you optimize entirely for scale and predictability, you really do strip away the texture of reality. Vartanian notes that even fashion heavyweights like Tom Ford and Demna Gvasalia are calling out this try-hard fatigue.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
And the newsletter underscores this point about blank replication with an incredible bonus fact about a Spanish collector named Rafael Pavon. He owns a collection of 730 Star Wars Stormtrooper helmets.
Just the standard blank white helmets.
Yes. And think about it. The Stormtrooper is a faceless character with no backstory and no individual identity. And yet it became the most reproduced toy in human history.
It's a blank slate.
Exactly. It serves as the perfect symbol for an era prioritizing endless blank replication over deep narrative, character, or genuine surprise.
We are literally mass producing the expected. Which brings us to the final piece of this puzzle, the death of the travel bug.
Right. Grant David Crawford, a philosophy professor, wrote a piece called The End of Elsewhere. He noticed that his university students simply do not argue about the ethics of travel anymore.
The burning desire to backpack across Europe or find oneself in Southeast Asia just isn't there.
No, it's really not. He traces the historical arc of the travel bug from Rousseau through the Romantics to the Beats and finally to Anthony Bourdain.
But why is it dying out now? Is it purely a financial mechanism?
Economics are absolutely a factor, sure. Students feel immense pressure to secure internships to survive in a fractured economy rather than taking gap years. Visas are harder to obtain and borders are tightening.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He also notes that international enrollment at U.S. universities is down 17%, meaning students are losing that cosmopolitan exposure right on their own campuses. But Crawford diagnoses a much deeper, more existential mechanism at play.
Which is?
A loss of belief in travel's transformative promise.
Oh, so they no longer believe that going to a new geographic location will actually alter who they are.
Right. Crawford writes this devastating line, "Authenticity is a story the tourist tells about herself, not a property of the place. If every destination has been optimized for the tourist economy, if every cafe and viewpoint has been reverse engineered to look good on an Instagram feed, then the magic is gone."
The destination has become predictable.
Yes. The surprise is gone.
It is the exact same mechanism as the AI poetry and the Met Gala outfits. If you already know exactly what a place will look like, feel like, and how it will perform on your feed before you even get on the airplane, why go? The surprise has been mathematically eliminated.
You know, pulling back to look at the entire landscape of the sources you provided, there is a concept from Timothy Garden Ash's interview that acts as the perfect skeleton key for everything we've discussed today.
Really? What is it?
When analyzing the governance of Hungary, he mentions the post-populist trilemma.
What are the 3 points of the trilemma?
It is the idea that a system can be rapid, it can be effective, or it can be legal, but it can only ever be two of those things at once. If you want something rapid and effective, you have to bypass legal or democratic checks.
Oh, wow. If we adapt that framework to culture and economics, it perfectly explains the fracturing we've seen today.
Right.
Think about it. We want rapid, effective wealth so we get billionaire founders scaling globally via government IP rules while we argue over whether they earned it. We want rapid, effective art so we use an LLM to generate a perfectly rhyming poem in 2 seconds, sacrificing the soul of it.
Yeah.
And we want rapid, effective authenticity so we manufacture viral Met Gala outfits and curate predictable travel feeds. But the legal, or in our case, the genuine, the authentic, the deeply human element is always the thing that gets sacrificed to achieve that speed and scale.
Because true authenticity and genuine surprise are fundamentally inefficient.
Mm.
They're not rapid or effective. It is Frost Angelico deciding to paint an inexplicable black stripe on a wall just to shock the viewer into paying attention.
Yeah.
In an era of total information overload, protecting your own ability to be surprised, refusing to allow your tastes and expectations to be flattened into a predictable token by an algorithm or a paralyzed political system might be the most vital skill you can develop.
You have to fight to keep your inner world from becoming an empty giant basket sitting in a cornfield. Which leaves us with one final provocative thought for you to mull over. We have seen how optimizing for the expected strips the magic out of our economy, our politics, and our art.
We really have.
So if authenticity is truly just a story we tell ourselves, and artificial intelligence is slowly but surely mastering the exact stories we expect to hear, will true value in the future, whether in politics, wealth, or art, belong entirely to those who can still manage to genuinely shock us? Think about it. We'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.